morning. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I would like to thank the organizers for having me here. For me, it's also special because working in this subject of quantum operations using Josephson junctions, I started to work on this in this area 5 years ago, first at NTT and then immediately after here at the ITP in the workshop on quantum computing. And I had no clue what it was, but I was interested, and then I started thinking about charges and later on flux qubits. And today I'll give you a progress report of where we are. Not far enough, never far enough, but certainly not far enough to seriously talk about quantum computing. But let me tell you where we are later. But first, I want to mention the collaborators here. We do this project in collaboration with several groups at MIT. Names are mentioned here, I won't go through them. What I talk about are main work mainly done by Casper, graduate student, and the new graduate student, Alexander Tahar, in this subject, and others also, and then Case Harmans, and he's not here, that works on measurements, and Frank Wilhelm on the theoretical interpretation, and lots of other people. Okay, the schedule of my talk is first, I'm not sure, most people will have heard about Josephson circuits, but I still want to make a few introductory remarks for those who don't. And then I'll discuss our particular device, talk about earlier results, and then discuss the latest results we have, and then draw some conclusions. So, we talk about Josephson circuits. This is an example. What you see here is, this is the size, micrometer. These are aluminum islands created by shadow evaporation, so you get these double lines. But using the shadow evaporation, we make these small tunnel junctions, aluminum, aluminum oxide, aluminum. They are, in our case, here in this picture, about 50 nanometers, but for the qubit I discussed, they are a bit larger because we want stronger coupling. What you see here are two islands, only connected through junctions. Junctions have a relatively high resistance of the order of the quantum resistance, so the charge on such an island can be controlled using a voltage gate. And there's another one there, so there are two islands here. And the other aspect that is visible here is that there are closed loops through junctions. If there is magnetic field in the loop, one can control the phase differences through the junction. So the sum of the gauge invariant phases have to add up to the enclosed flux. So this is another way to operate these circuits. And to make it a bit more quantitative, we have these two regimes, the charge regime, charging regime, and here we use junctions where the Josephson coupling energy, which is connected to the resistance, the tunneling resistance, in the way given here, is smaller than the charging energy, E squared over 2c, is larger than the Josephson energy. Then the thing is operated in a charge regime, and this is the subject of later talks, next talk and others. Where we work is in the phase regime, flux regime, where the Josephson energy dominates, but still the charging energy is, not that much smaller, because otherwise we end up in the classical regime. So now here we have quantum behavior of the phase variables. So that is the general background. That's all I will say about these circuits. Now, as I said, we work in the flux regime. First thing to mention is, why do we do that? Because the charge regime in many ways is simpler, more elegant, controlling single Cooper pairs and make superpositions of charge states. In practice, in these circuits, we all find a very strong charge noise. Charge is not a stable quantity. If you make a circuit, there's a static offset of the charge, and then if you run it, you find a strong noise component. So that is not very helpful. Now, of course, there's also flux noise, etc. But still, it's intuition, it's a gamble, nobody knows, but we decided to go for the flux qubits. And we'll see how far everything comes. So what we have designed together with MIT is the circuit. The basic circuit is a loop, three junctions. Three is the minimum number to have two stable, or let's say metastable states. Because it's a loop, there are two independent phase differences. And if we plot the Josephson energy as a function of those two phase differences, we get minima. And if we make cross-sections in the picture here, we get a cross-section with a barrier. And these are the two states. In this case, the flux is not exactly half a flux quantum. For exactly half a flux quantum, these valleys, they would be degenerate, they would be symmetrical. Now one is favored a bit more over the other. And using the flux, we can put in some energy difference between those states. These states correspond to circulating currents, persistent currents that go clockwise or anti-clockwise. I never know which is which, but I mean, if you force me, I can tell you, but it's obviously connected with magnetic field, etc. So there are these two states. Now there's a tunnel barrier, there's a barrier between the two states, and the height of that barrier is obviously controlled. This is plotted, scaled with the Josephson energy. So it scales with the size of the junctions and the critical current. And so the barrier thickness is important. So if we choose it right, we can have the barrier low enough so that there is quantum tunneling. Now for quantum tunneling, also the dynamics is important. So that is where the mass comes in this story. So the tunneling matrix element contains in the exponent the Josephson energy, but also the charging energy, which is the inverse mass. So if the areas of the junctions are large, we have a high mass, and then the tunneling is slower. Now in practice, we choose Ej over Ec to be around 80. It's pretty high, but still, then we have very strong tunneling, very significant tunneling. We can easily make circuits where the tunneling is so strong and where the mass is so small that the levels are way up here and we cannot really distinguish them. So by choosing parameters, we can really design the quantum properties of the circuit. Now another aspect is that by choosing to work in the flux regime, we will have the flux noise, but also in principle, we have the charge noise. In these circuits, the dynamics, the quantum dynamics contain charges, charge properties, as well as flux properties. And because Ej is larger here, their influence is reduced, but we have reduced it even further by choosing the barriers in such a way that in this phase plot, we can only move between those along the red line here, but we cannot tunnel from here to there. And if we can go here, we can also go on and move through whole phase space. Once we can move through the whole phase space, we connect, this is a continuous motion of phase, which is momentum, and that connects to charge. So by reducing this kind of tunneling, we disconnect the system quite strongly, even stronger than just by choosing the high Ej, we disconnect from the charge noise. So this is an additional feature. We can choose the ratio between those barriers by choosing the value of that of one of the three junctions. If they're all three equal, the barriers are equally high. But if this one is a bit smaller, we can make this barrier higher than that. So that's another feature we can play with. And the other thing that we plan to use, but there's so many things we have to do first, we are learning that we didn't do it yet. Another way is that by varying the value of this junction in situ, we can modulate the barrier height. And we can do that by making this top junction a double junction and then changing the flux in that top loop independent from the flux in the total loop. And then we can modulate the barrier here. So this is also a useful property if you want to excite the system. Okay, that's the system. Now, if we have a qubit like that, we of course want to do measurements, etc. So what we have are two states. This is applied flux to a loop. This is the symmetry point, half a flux quantum. We have the slopes here, and because there is quantum tunneling, we have the avoided crossing here, and the energy is just the square root of the, let's say, the magnetic energy, which is proportional to the difference with the half and the tunnel and the two squares, and then the square root of that. Now the derivative, this is the blue is the ground state, and the red, of course, the excited state. The derivative of the energy is the persistent current. So the current in the ground state moves from a low value to a high value. In the excited state, it's the opposite. That current in this loop generates a magnetic moment, which is relatively small, but large enough to be measured. So what we have is the loop. This is the real sample with three junctions, and then a squid close around it, as shown in that picture there. So this is the way we detect the states of the qubit. Now this is tricky business. We have a single quantum object, and we want to do a measurement on it. We put a strong measuring instrument to it, we kill the quantum properties. So this is very intricate balance, and I would not claim that we really understand all the aspects of it. I'll come back to that. So we have the practical values. I mentioned some. The typical level splitting where we work, if we work away from the symmetry point, is something like 10 gigahertz. And then the tunnel strengths, we can adjust. We can make it larger or smaller. It's typically something like 1 gigahertz or half a gigahertz. Loop sizes are like that, so the generated flux is about 10 minus 3 flux quanta. Okay. These are just to show that we can choose different values. Now, the squid, what do we require here? The squid cannot be too strong because it's coupled to the qubit. So the critical currents have to be small. Actually, the critical current of the squid, the junctions of the squid are smaller than the qubit junctions, just to prevent too strong back action.
What is the difference between the tunnel strength and the level splitting?
Sorry.
You put the different numbers for tunnel strength and level splitting.
Level splitting, sorry, let me go back. If you look at this picture, these are these energies. So level splitting depends on applied flux. So level splitting here is, for instance, 10 gigahertz. Tunnel strength is the separation here. Because at half a flux quantum, the only level separation is due to the tunneling between the two states. Yeah? Okay. Okay, sorry, where was I now? I'm going too fast. The squid. The squid has to be underdamped. We cannot use a regular squid with a normal metal shunt because that normal metal is dissipative. We connect to the quantum dynamics. It will be damped. There's too much dissipation. So we need a completely hysteretic underdamped squid. We still have to measure the critical current of the squid. The squid is a double junction that, and the total critical current depends on the enclosed flux. That's what we use. We measure the critical current by measuring a switching current. What we do is ramp up the current through the squid and detect when it switches to a voltage. So as soon as, we have a linear ramp, and if we measure a voltage, we record the time, in fact, or let's say the current at that time, which is the switching current. We do that many times. 5,000, 10,000 times, and then we take the average. And that is the measurement point. And the ramping is done in something like 15 milliseconds, and to take a point takes a few minutes, depending on what you do. Average values record. So we get a histogram, and because it's a weak system, there are quantum fluctuations, and there's still not much, but a little bit of thermal fluctuations also. So we get a histogram of switching currents. The width is about 3%. And actually, that histogram is significantly wider than the signal that we measure, which means that if we do a single switching current measurement, we don't know whether the qubit is up or down. So a single measurement does not give us a quantum measurement. It's not a single shot measurement. We think we can do that, but that will be a later story and it will take us by the pace that we go now, about 2 years to do that, I think. So what we do is basically an ensemble measurement. So we do a repeated measurement on the quantum system, which is equivalent to measuring on, let's say, 5 or 10,000 quantum systems at the same time, like, or let's say, NMR like. Okay, this is what we get. This is now, so let's say if that is the energy plot, this is a typical, this is a recent one. What you see here is, a background has been subtracted. If we look at the qubit system signal, what we see here is a step. Each point here is a histogram, so it's the average of 5 or 10,000 points or something like that. So we have many points here. To take this plot takes a few hours, depending on the resolution that you want. So this is the crossover. Now, if you apply RF, an RF flux to the loop, if that RF frequency is resonant with the level splitting, we get transitions and we see them, so we can do spectroscopy, as you see. Because of the symmetry of the energies, there will be a resonant on the left and another one symmetric on the right, and that's of course what you see here. So one of the, in this case, the ground state has the highest switching current, and here the ground state has the lowest switching current. So if you excite the system to the excited state, I mean, you see transitions. And as you can see, we come about halfway here, so there's, let's say, certainly a strong effect. Actually, we come lower here, which we don't really understand sometimes. Okay, now we can change the frequency and see how the plot varies. I mean, to go back, if we change the frequency, we move along, I mean, the energy difference gets, I mean, the resonance points creeps toward the half a flux quantum. That's what we see. Lower frequencies, these things get closer and closer together. Really, at half a flux quantum, we have no signal because both states have zero flux. So we see nothing. It dies out here, but we can still follow it. And if we plot it, now we can plot the energy difference as a function of the applied flux, and then we see a straight line here, but here it curves off. It curves off significantly if we do an error analysis, and that proves that we have a quantum superposition of our two states, which is not a trivial thing because this is a large object that contains a billion Cooper pairs, and all the Cooper pairs, the whole system of all those Cooper pairs is in a superposition where they all go left or right at the same time in the middle here. And that is clearly observed, and also observed in Stony Brook at the same time. Now, this was nice, but this is 1.5 years ago. Most of you heard about it, and this was wonderful that we saw it, etc. And now we went on. And what did we achieve? Not much, I have to warn you. But we've been working hard and still are working hard. And let me try to explain what the problems are. Okay, so what we really want is not to do spectroscopy, obviously, although it's nice that it's possible and that we see, a transition and that we can excite the system, see where it is, etc. Spectroscopy is nice. What we really want to do is controlled quantum operations. We want to put on a pulse, an RF pulse, and move the system from, let's say, a pure ground state to a pure excited state, not just to some incoherent mixture, as you saw before. And then, of course, we also want to make controlled superpositions of those two states of the qubit. So we want to move, if we take the Bloch sphere of the system, we have the two states, we want to control every motion. If we make a quantum computer, we have to be able to move from any point on the Bloch sphere to any other point there. So we have to control both, the latitude, right? Let me get it right, and the longitude on this system. So we have to deal with, and then the bad things happening correspond to relaxation between the two states, and then dephasing, where this phase, this warmer precession phase, that information is lost. So we have to reduce those two effects. Now, in order to do that, we have to understand our measuring process much better. We worked quite hard on understanding what was going on. And in our system, it's relatively complicated. We have our quantum system, and then we have the classical environment. But it goes in steps because, I mean, the connection to the environment, apart from other connections, stray flux, etc., but the necessary connection is through the squid, the transport current through the squid. We have the measurement as a transport current that connects to classical leads, so that's a classical property. But the squid, with the two junctions, has two variables, and there's the phase difference of the two junctions in the squid, and that actually, because the squid is very small, is a quantum property. So this is quite strongly, these two things are strongly linked. So what we really study is the combination of the quantum bit and the inner variable of the squid, tightly linked. Not much freedom in between, because small, there's not much inductance, so no freedom here. And now the connection from here to there, we need a connection to do the measurement, but as soon as we connect, we get the environment leaking into the system here. So now the whole story is, how do you do a measurement without, I mean, once you switch on the measurement, you destroy the quantum properties. How do you do that, and how can you control that? Now the coupling between those two properties of the squid depends very strongly on the transport current. At zero transport current, in the simplest approximation, in a completely symmetric squid, there is no connection between the circulating current and the transport current. The critical current, that connection is extremely strong. So when we ramp up the current, during the ramp, we more and more switch on this environment to the quantum system. So the ideal thing is to ramp it up very fast, much faster than the dephasing, I mean, all the times in the system, relevant times. But if we, ramping up through leads is not so easy. And the other thing is, once we open the leads to allow this fast ramping, we also open it up to the noise coming from the environment. So we have to filter very heavily, there are electrical connections from here to there, etc. So we need to have extremely strong filtering and many checks on the way. Otherwise, just sitting there, the quantum properties are destroyed. So to get it, that makes it very difficult to ramp fast enough. So this is the tricky part. Now, this is what we do anyway. We hope later to do inductive readout, but there, let's see, I will not talk about it. Then we can measure at lower transport current values. Now, if we analyzed the properties, and Frank Wilhelm and Kasper and others spent a long time discussing it, and this is the result. So this is what we should be able to do. With a simple, straightforward measurement without changing barriers, this is in practice what we should be able to achieve on paper. We are very far from it, I can warn you. This is a tricky part. The analysis seems to indicate that it's not so important, but we still need a fuller analysis, and also we have to worry about paramagnetic impurities, and these may be serious. But this, in principle, we would be able. It should be possible to do this. And this would be very nice, because even 20 microseconds is very long, and we can run the system in, let's say, order 10 nanoseconds, so that would be a very good ratio between operation time and so you could do 1,000 operations. And then we could put in the other tricks with barriers, etc., to improve that. So that is the idea. But practice is different. Now, to optimize all this, in the analysis, one needs to adapt the impedance of the environment to the system you want to study. And the consequence, for instance, was that we put a very strong capacitance, right, this is the squid here, a very large capacitance, to shunt the system, on the one hand to reduce noise coming from the outside, but also to provide a very low resonance between the low frequency resonance between the LC circuit of the squid and this capacitance. So to move that away from the energy difference, which is good. Okay. But what we find is not quite what we calculate. Now, we do have some new results relative to, let's say, more than a year ago. And this is the measurement we did this spring. What we were able to do is the following. We put on bursts of microwave. Of course, we tried to do Rabi oscillations to put microwave pulses and to see the signal go from the ground state to the excited state and back and measure that. Now, we didn't work. We couldn't get it out. And if we look at our spectroscopy lines, we see that the width of those lines is, let's say, 300 megahertz or 200 megahertz on a 10 gigahertz separation. That is, that corresponds to a dephasing time. I'll come back to that, but that would correspond to a dephasing time of, let's say, the order of a nanosecond, where our operations are taking a few nanoseconds. So it's clear that the width of that transition of the spectroscopic line is too high to do the Rabi with our measurement technique at this time, the way it is. But what we could do is the following. Excite the system in a relatively incoherent way. Just give a RF burst and repeat that, keep doing that, and then switch it off and then change the length of that time in between. So obviously, if now we focus on the relaxation time. And if the relaxation rate is fast and you wait long, there will be nothing left. The signal will have disappeared. And if it's short, so what we see is a signal. So we do these bursts all the time, and we measure also many times. So the real measurement comes ramping up. So this is, through these bursts, and then we take the average, etc. So we see an average population of the whole system. And we see, and we can fit that with a relaxation assumptions in a relatively simple way. And then we see it fall off. And from this fall off, we can deduce the relaxation time. So this is the principle, and this is a measurement. So what you see here are these, this is a dip, a spectroscopic dip. And then, as you see, we vary the time, and let's say it's four microseconds, it's still clearly visible. So you can see how it moves. And we can plot that and do that for different frequencies, and then fit, and we get out that relaxation times are, let's say, around 1 microsecond, which is far away from the millisecond that we calculate for this system. But still, microsecond to begin with is not bad. It's the dephasing time that is the bad part. Now, it's very difficult to tell you what we were doing all this last half year, because it turned out if we studied and we did all these measurements, and these measurements take time. And to make a new sample, when you think, okay, let's improve something, to make a new sample, put it in, do the measurement, typical time scale is half a year. So it's very easy to change things on paper. It's not so easy in a completely new system nobody has studied before, to find out what's going on and then to adapt to it. And that's what we're trying to do. But what we found is that the external electronics, not on the chip, but just changing the external electronics, we could vary this relaxation time. So what I showed you, the previous one and now a new one, and all we did is the same sample, we changed some properties of the external system. Now, I won't give you the details. Now, it's very clear that the results are different, the values are different, they're higher here, because we improved things. But what we suddenly have is that it does not depend on frequency anymore. Now, we don't understand that, but my conclusion at this time is that very probably this relaxation rate is limited still by the electronics. I mean, this has nothing to do with the impedance on the chip, etc., where we did, let's say, the impedance of the environment and that whole analysis. What we did here is just purely the driving circuit outside. And if that can change what you measure, I don't believe it's an intrinsic value. So this is good news. I mean, we have the 1 microsecond, and if we can improve it by something, I mean, if we work on it, there's every reason to believe that we can still improve that. Okay. Now, what we do not control is the dephasing, and we need to improve that very much. We need to narrow the lines. And there we also changed certain things, and we have many ideas. So we did some new analysis, and this now has to do with more with temperatures in different places, nothing intrinsic about impedance of the environment. Just so this is what we should be able to get with what we think now. Now this is something we have started worrying about, and the present sample has paramagnetic impurities. It sounds stupid, but we immediately ordered the purest aluminum that we could have because we did some analysis and it could have strong effects. But we don't really know that. Now, with dephasing, our conclusion is, let me move on to this line width, that we did some careful measurements now of the magnetic flux in our system. Now, we can only do that on a slow time scale because our squid measurement system is slow. We have to average many times. Remember, our qubit signal is much smaller than the histogram width, so we have to average over a long time to get any significant value. So we can measure flux variations on the scale of minutes and longer. And what we measured is that there are still quite strong variations, so we need to go to a persistent current type of operation. And then also we can put in many improvements, all kinds of technical things to get that at least an order of magnitude better. It was not as good as we thought it should be, and so we think that that can be improved. So this is what we measure, and it has to be at least an order of magnitude better, and we hope to see that. Now, the conclusion at this time is that again, technical things matter. And that means that we are not yet, I think, looking at an intrinsic dephasing mechanism. It could be just around the corner, but we haven't hit it yet because we find that using different electronics, we still vary there. So our idea is just to keep going. But we have learned that the going is slow. It's an uphill battle through the bush or whatever. We have to fight for every small step, but we are still moving, and we have hope that we can reach, get better results. There's still reason to be optimistic. Now let me show you a few data that might be of interest. I mean, that's what I told you was the main message. We are moving slowly, but now let me show you a few data. Microwave power we can vary. There was one thing we thought was interesting, because now we last year improved the microwave coupling very much. We put the system in a cavity which excludes all kinds of resonances. Let's say a cavity with very the lowest mode much higher than the qubit splitting. That helps a lot. We have controlled coupling now all the way from room temperature to the qubit. We know what the attenuation is on the way. We have, let's say, professional transfer of that, so that's good. And now the result is that we can put huge amounts of power to the qubit without heating the dilution fridge too much. And one of the consequences is that if we put much power, we now see harmonics. So the main line is this, but you can see that there is also a transition now, a spectroscopic transition at double the energy, when the energy is double the frequency. But not only there, also subharmonics. So these are a bit more difficult to understand, but I don't think it is so complicated. It's because at these high amplitudes, you really excite the qubit, and you get nonlinear terms doing all kinds of things. So we get harmonics and subharmonics. The conclusions. I think it's clear. We can do spectroscopy. We have already a long time before seen the superpositions. But at the present time, we are stuck with a relaxation time and a microsecond and, let's say, something that broadened line and apparent dephasing, or let's say inhomogeneous broadening of around a nanosecond. And in particular, this thing needs to be improved. Now, if we look at our systems, we had redesigned it to be optimal for the impedance matching and the whole environment discussion. Now we go back to much more mundane considerations like trapped flux and all these things. And we think we can improve this, and we have to see where we are. Thank you. Sorry, spins in the aluminum, etc. Yeah, nucleus.
So, but it's a superconductor, right? And it's a gaseous superconductor. So why spins?
I immediately look at Leonia Levitov, who is the expert, our expert here on this subject. But there are all kinds of aspects. So there is a static offset, and that is supposed to be very slow, at least. It could be there, small but constant. From the analysis, yeah?
Is that like an homogeneous broadening?
Yeah, but I have no reason to think that it are these spins doing it.
So, what else? I mean, is there any evidence that spins are important?
No.
Any idea why they are important?
No, there are certainly other things that are at least as important. But I'm talking about now experiments that we did in the last weeks. I mean, this is really things in the last weeks, which are, not refined and not analyzed, etc. But yeah, we found that even the current drive of our magnet, we use a big magnet coil, this big, that had too much noise, more than it should have. And we improved it a bit, and that helped a bit, but not quite enough. And then if we measure the flux, there is more flux noise, nothing to do with the qubit, etc. So, and also we have two squids there, and they have the same. So it seems that it's a faraway source. So we are looking for trapped flux mainly. And we are mentally taking apart the system and looking where can something like flux be trapped, and what can we do about it. Yeah.
Well, with nuclear spins, it's simple. So the current is producing magnetic field. Magnetic field interacts with the nuclear spin, and this is the source of the interference. But I have another question.
The real question is, how strong is it? I mean, it's there, but how strong is it? And our calculation says that it's not so strong, that it would not be limiting.
Yes, yeah. My other question is, what do you think is happening to the angular momentum when the current in the loop tunnels between clockwise and counterclockwise direction?
You mean the world turns a bit slower? I think so, yeah.
Well, yeah. What happens to that?
Yeah, that is. That is.
Momentum, right?
Yeah,
with
yeah.
The
so, yeah, yeah. It must be the world picking up that angular momentum, yeah. It's real. It's real Cooper pairs, I mean, electrons with mass that really move in this way and that way. It is macroscopic.
But this means that you need strong interaction with the environment, right? As you begin to decouple your system from the environment, you cannot conserve the angular momentum, and then the coherent tunneling will not occur. So where is the middle? On one hand, you need weak interaction with the environment to have weak decoherence. On the other hand, as it gets weaker, you cannot conserve angular momentum. Is that right?
I have no direct answer to that, no. But, oh.
This is more like what it's seen in a crystal field. There is no spherical symmetry, so the angular momentum. So there is an isotropic coupling in a sense. This qubit spin is not, is in the Z direction,
right.
Plus or minus. So angular momentum.
The current is angular momentum in the Z direction. And then it jumps in the opposite orientation of the moment, right? When the car goes in the opposite direction. And then the momentum, I believe, is something like 10 to the 11th power one constant, right?
So there are transitions at least. I mean, that we know. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. It's a theoretical question. I suppose you can answer.
Yeah, yeah. I don't have that answer ready. No. But
the correct answer is that if you write down the Hamiltonian, it will not be spherical symmetric in spin space, because this is an isotropic crystal field. And so there will be no issue about that.
Yeah, but that's the complicated discussion. But there are real Cooper pairs moving this way and later in the other way.
No.
So it has to be packed up. I mean, if you think of it as a simple macroscopic object.
Well, the macroscopic
no.
Curve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, I don't know.
Hence, we'll be here for a week. So we can pick up.
Yeah.
There's a question
over there. You mentioned several times that changes in the external circuit affect what's happening inside. What type of changes?
Oh, change. Yeah, one example, we heated up the system, kept the qubit there, but put resistors on the outside. It's all in a can, and on the outside we put ohmic damping, something like that. And also we changed, we had some grounding problem. We have a completely new system that this run is the first run that we have a new dilution fridge, new electronics, new connections, new lines, new RF. So there were some grounding problems still, although on a very low level, but we could improve that. Things like that. I mean, simple technical things that you don't want to know, but still have to be done. Yeah.
I understand that if you have an ohmic environment that is coupled to your qubit,
yeah.
It has a bad effect of.
Yeah.
And this is the reason why you want unshunted junctions in
yeah.
this grid. How should I think about the back action of the switching itself? On
it's very strong. By the time you get to the switching, the back action is very strong. So what we need to have is that when we ramp up the current, there will be dephasing and relaxation induced by the back action. So what we will first, I mean, the dephasing will be strong, but that doesn't matter. If you want to measure anyway, you don't care about the phase anymore. Yeah, as long as you know when you have this measuring phenomenon. And then if you keep ramping, yeah.
The advantage in comparison to the ohmic environment is that the dephasing occurs time slot that you care less about.
If you, sorry, no, let me put it the other way. If we take a squid that is shunted enough to make it non-hysteretic, which is an easier measurement, then the back action is too strong. The dissipation just through the coupling of that ohmic resistor through the squid to the qubit is too strong and we would not have transition. No. But we also study and we have no results yet. We study another system where we use like 1,000 qubits and then make the coupling very weak. And now we can afford to couple the squid permanently, we think, on paper. But now we have to deal with 1,000 qubits or 10,000 qubits that have inhomogeneous broadening because they're all a bit different. And that is another problem. Yeah.
Okay, I think we should stop there.